Okay, welcome to Colors of the Dark from Fangoria. It should be called Color of the Dark because sadly, right before our flights, Becca got sick and couldn't make it. And it threw us in a momentary spin because Becca loves this festival. Like Becca was, first all in for Fantasia. And I kind of said, well, I know Heidi Honeycutt is at the festival or going to be at the festival. And we worked together a decade ago on a podcast.
Yes.
So I know we can do this last minute. We had to change a lot of the graphics and format, but we pulled it off. So big thank you to Heidi Honeycutt.
Well, I'm super happy to be here. Yeah. So, in fact, Elric and I have known each other for so long. I actually wore my Fearnet tank top. Do you guys remember Fearnet? Because that was when we first met.
It was right around.
Fearnet was big then.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was super excited to be here. And I'm really sorry I'm not Becca. Becca is smarter than me.
But you're Heidi Honeycutt.
But I'm Heidi. So hopefully I will do a good job
of
Heidi
with humor. The difference is.
Yeah, it's my defense mechanism. Yeah.
So if there's any bumps, it's because we are literally doing this for the first time. But we are thrilled, and we definitely didn't want to have this collapse because we got to talk to somebody, a creative who I've wanted to talk to since the run of these shows. One of our old co-hosts got to talk to you, Ryan Turk, got to do a big in-depth with you on The Blob. And I think he introduced you at like CineFamily way back when.
Yeah.
For a screening. And we were always like, why aren't you bringing Chuck on the main show? Because we're all huge fans of what you do. And so let's welcome Chuck Russell to the show.
Yay!
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And when we look back at looking at the thing that sometimes I bemoan, like what is missing sometimes from films for me now, when we think back to like what we loved about the 80s, our generation loved about those movies, was the kind of brilliant imagination fused with practical effects. And just it felt like a world, I felt like a little piece of magic that maybe has been, CGI'd out a little bit.
I totally agree. Yeah? I totally agree. And while it was really exciting, we were pioneering CGI on The Mask. People didn't even know what it kind of was that early. And I said, let's apply it to comedy. If we can get this guy, Jim Carrey, who's already kind of a special effect.
And he wasn't that well known yet, right?
Besides, no, look, there was a whole thing with New Line. They had to trust me. And I still, Bob Shea and Mike DeLuca, thank you. And Toby Emmerich, too. They really wanted to make a horror film. The Mask was supposed to be a horror film, and I happen to have seen the comic, which was the original comic was black and white splatterpunk, we called it, where he'd do a one-liner and pull an axe out of his pocket and chop everybody up, and it was, brilliantly imaginative, but I felt it would be very similar to Freddy at the end of the day in film. And I'd seen Jim's Carrey's stand-up in L.A. and seen him on In Living Color. I just said, there's somebody coming who's just brilliant. And it took a year. They said no. And then a year later, they said, what were you saying about a Jim Carrey and a girl and a dog and a nightclub? And they came back around.
And so, it feels like a Tex Avery cartoon. Literally.
Well, was very inspired by Tex Avery. And my grandparents who babysat me back in the day, my grandpa used to play trumpet in Dixieland bands. So we listened to Cab Calloway all the time.
Oh,
so I wanted to go 40s. And New Line was going, we actually can get you Aerosmith. What are you doing? And I still want to work with Aerosmith. But there was only one way all those pieces fit together in my head. So I tried to keep it on track,
Let's go way back. Because a lot of my generation and below are heavily influenced by your films, the films of the 80s, these films that had that kind of magic. But for you, like, what are some of the earliest movies that made you in terms of, when you're coming up, whether it's television or in cinema?
I can tell you, I've heard a couple directors say this. When I was a kid, I saw some rerun of Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Oh, yeah.
And in my little childlike brain, I thought, that's somebody's daddy's job. Mm. That's the way I thought of it. My dad took the train to work every day, and I had no idea what.
Did you come to that on your own? Because I was saying I didn't feel that way about movies until I saw short films. And when I saw a short film, I could see a handmade quality that suddenly made me realize you could do this versus this perfect machine.
I was doing a little claymation with an 8mm camera, not well, but I was fascinated with it. And I don't know why, but I remember that epiphany quite clearly. That's unbelievable. That's somebody's job, and. That kind of stayed in my head. I was born on a farm and raised mostly in Chicago suburbs. worked in Chicago around Lincoln Park where people were doing plays, and I got the Jones for that. But where I come from, saying you want to be a film director is like saying you want to be an astronaut. You know, it's unlikely. So, I mean, I wasn't good at much else. So that narrowed it down, and I came out to L.A. and got a job sweeping stages. So,
nice. So were there films you saw that, you know, when you're still in Chicago that gave you that confidence? Like, oh, people are making these things that are more like, you know, the world I see. I got to get out there.
I don't recall thinking those. I'll tell you what the truth is. In college at University of Illinois, I saw in an art house, art film, Francois Truffaut's Day for Night. So it's quite a different reference than Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. But I was lamenting finishing college where I was directing and writing one-act plays and loving it, thinking, well, now I have to go into the real world and I have no idea, but it's not going to be this much fun. And Day for Night is really, I still recommend it. It's a film about the joy of filmmaking, which is a modern equivalent of running away to join the circus. It's showing this little independent French film company. It's a wonderful Truffaut film. And showing the interaction between the neurotic actors and the director and the prop people and how you shoot Day for Night. I found the whole thing so magical. And I decided, you know, I really want to try that. I really want to try that. So I said, who's coming with me to my theater friends? Nobody. Until 5 years later, they, Chuck, can we have a job? You know.
When you say Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, I think probably a lot of people in the audience also feel that way about that film. I know I do. And in particular, the animation. And your films, not, even if it's not the center of the film, there's always an element of that animation
I love magic,
in there.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, can you just talk a little bit about that? How there's that...
Guys, I want you to see Witchboard because it's so fun. Everything you're saying, it's why I came back to horror. Because I was, you know, serving different masters in different genres and having fun doing it. And I really wanted to come back to horror, but not slasher films. By the way, I love and respect all kinds of films. But the real dystopian, everybody dies at the end kind of movie always leaves me feeling empty, personally. And I think the challenge for a filmmaker is to say, can we make it really scary, but root for the hero? And can I put the audience in the position of saying, there are real spiritual evil forces in this world. We've all rubbed up against some form of that. So I try to make it, you know, real in my head. And how can you outwit that, not make it simple, and make it happen at great cost? Which, by the way, is one of my basic rules, that magic costs the practitioner, which they never did in the Sinbad movies. The wizard would just go like this and a dragon would pop up and no one even broke a sweat. So even in The Mask, when Jim pulls the mask off, it hurts. You know, there has to be a cost to the practitioner. We, the filmmakers, have to understand the internal logic. Even if you're not going to do all the exposition, if you can do it just visually, if we, the filmmaker, know all the rules, then we can dole it out in internal logic as much as the audience might care to take in. So, you know, I do love that. I went back to Witchboard because I thought, I can do everything I ever didn't get to do yet and try to top my other horror films.
Yeah, I mean, we can jump around in general, but coming back to Witchboard, what was the inspiration? Was it the original movie, or did you have ideas of things you wanted to do that you would then try to work out within the frame of this IP?
I saw it as a springboard, a little bit like The Blob, where the original is like a really resonant piece, call it horror real estate. All right, we know the movie. It was something a lot of us saw when we were kids. I know it's a word game, but for me, I reimagined it, and I saw that as a terrific springboard. It was very original at the time, and I believe it actually started the Ouija board subgenre in horror, if that's true. So I give Kevin Tenney plenty of credit. But there have been a few Ouija board movies since, and I suddenly had an epiphany because I have been fascinated with pendulum boards. I've studied enough magic with practitioners. It's all real. Magic is real in our head. It's vibrational, right? So I'm not saying pendulum boards work. I think all these devices are a gateway drug to trouble, by the way, and will not play Ouija boards myself because I respect that. But pendulum boards and that property just hit something in my head because I knew they could be so visual and they're used for spell casting. I wasn't stuck with an alphabet soup of, you know, it's already been done with the spirit sending messages, but spell casting and divination and what pendulum boards really were in the 1700s, the reason Ouija boards exist for a fact is that you got burned at the stake if you were caught with a pendulum board. The French Pope in the 1700s outlawed them. And it was a big part of some of the really horrific things that happened unfairly in the witch trials. So knowing that there's a deep history and just having some visual ideas I wanted to experiment with, and doing a film that I could play with all the things I like in nightmares and dreams and magic, I thought, okay, great. I can go back to horror and do something really imaginative. And that was my whole the whole reason to jump into Witchboard.
And you actually have flashbacks in the film, historical.
So you've seen the film?
No, but I know a lot about it.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking forward to seeing
Spoilers are out.
Tomorrow night. Tomorrow night,
yes.
9 o'clock.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated by that you wanted to include that origin story, which is really cool.
Another thing that I've seen, I like it, but I've seen it too much, is the kind of now you see them, now you don't found footage stuff, which is very effective and amazing. Because the audience is doing most of the work, right? But I didn't want like a witch shadow. I wanted to know. I think antagonists are scarier and more driven if we understand what made them that way. So for me, I'm fascinated with herbal medicine and natural remedies. And women were oppressed in those days, and people still are. There are very effective natural remedies that are a problem. Because other people can't make money on them. So I don't want to give away too much about the film, there are elements of that in the film. As wild as the film is, and I took the brakes off, as wild as the film is, a lot of it's based on real history.
Did you come across anyone? I remember going in Salem, Massachusetts. They have it's a museum for Ouija boards, and it had every kind of board imaginable. And I just remember, you know, whatever you believe, there's a bit of a presence you can often feel with antiquities.
I'm telling you, I actually try to show some respect for Wicca, and it's still popular. If you don't know, there's wonderful people that are interested in that. But I think be careful. Careful what you play with. But I try to represent why some of our characters were interested in Wicca. And then I also tried to show that revenge is very dark Wicca and where that could lead to. So, you know, I think there are dark spaces. I've been on, interestingly enough, while I worked as a location scout, I ended up in a couple of places without trying that were legitimately haunted that I had to get out of because you're there by yourself taking pictures. And sure enough, I found out later this was the scene of a suicide. Mm-hmm. I think the spiritual world crosses over into hard science because we're all vibrational. And you can leave a hole in a building with a dark event. And those are things I'm very cautious with. And in my films, love, whether it's love among a group of friends or romantic love, can be not an antidote, but you know, a way to combat that at some cost. So nothing's easy in my way of viewing that world.
I have a question. Yeah. So when I was a little girl, my sister and I were playing with our Ouija board, and it was the one you would get from the toy store, right? But we took it very seriously, and we were playing with it, and we were in the bathroom, and it was really dark, and we had the lights turned off, and we had a candle, and then we were playing around, and then I got scared, and I took my hands off.
Good.
And the candle went out.
Good tip. Leave the room. Turn the lights on.
But my sister said, no, you can't just take your hands off. You have to like seal it or the demons come through.
Thank you,
right?
Sister.
So I'm just wondering, was that a really bad idea? Did that explain everything?
Look, I don't consider myself
happened to me.
I just think you have to treat these things with respect. I happen to be a big believer in God, capital G God. And all you got to do is meditate a little bit. You imagine yourself in God's hand. What does he allow in the world? So I'm not going to preach here, and I'm not attached to any particular religion. But in my experience, I've been on a cliff face in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, praying like a pastor, hanging on during a stunt when something went wrong in a stunt. So I believe in both sides. Yeah, I believe in both sides. So you're okay.
Okay,
I think there's an obsession danger. And that's what, if there are bad spirits, that's what they like.
Okay.
But just text in your questions about Ouija board to him right now, and we'll answer these live. Anyone?
No.
Let's talk about, you talked about difficulties. I'm really curious. You move out to LA, and it's always a huge plunge. Like probably a lot of people in this room have done this at some point. You did it at a period. when you went out there, what was your expectation of what you thought you were going to be doing in movies? Because you're somebody we were just talking off air about. A friend just bought a movie called Body Rock to my house a couple weeks ago. I knew I was going to be doing the show. Had no clue your name pops up. And then I'm watching a movie about breakdancing in the 80s shot by the guy who made, you know, shot Paris, Texas. And I'm like, what the heck?
Robbie
Lawrence
Mueller.
Lamas.
Yeah,
and
great
and you're there. And that was part of your experience, part of your journey. And so to me, it's excitingly eclectic, you know, your filmography and journey. So starting with a lot of producing, but what did you think was going to happen when you first came? And then talk us through just some of those first jobs that just starts that path.
It's a long story. I was a slow starter, but I was persistent. Okay. So we didn't have cell phones and, you know, the internet wasn't a big thing, barely being invented, but I wasn't a film student. I didn't have money for film school. I wasn't poor, but I didn't have money for film school. And, my family thought I was crazy. I gave myself, let me try this for 2 years because I literally didn't like anything else. And I was convinced by my parents that they wanted me to be in a traditional business. And I didn't have a head for it, in my opinion. But I was so thrilled to be in LA. I didn't care that I was sweeping stages. Yeah. I literally was that idiot cleaning up behind the elephants, literally doing bags of fertilizer for a Dash Mobile commercial.
What are you, like 18, 19?
Yeah, something like that. I went back and forth once, but I was a kid. And so I had time as a young man to do the shit jobs, but enjoy them, you know? So my recommendation to my friends and to everybody is, if you're going to try that kind of thing, people love giving young people a break. Don't wait too long.
Yeah.
You know, don't become a graduate in film. And you know, if you actually want to make movies, I mean, I don't mean nothing bad against the film school, but don't stay in school forever. Yeah. Get out there and do your work. Nowadays, I think you could do short films on your iPhone. You know, I probably would have taken a different path if I felt there was their opportunity. There wasn't even short film marketplaces that I recall back in the day. So it was a thrilling time for independent film. Roger Corman was still functioning. It was really arcing out, but, you know, that was the place to go, and they would get anybody a chance willing to work hard. So a big part of what I did was really just keep my mouth shut and work really hard. And I worked my way up from sweeping the stages to getting the coffee at Stunts Unlimited, which I loved, because all they did was stunt units and there was no CGI. So people were really like setting themselves on fire and really crashing cars into each other head on. And I learned safety craft, honestly, in stunts and the respect how you did that stuff.
Did you also learn how they're shooting it?
Oh, yeah.
To keep that magic.
Oh, yeah. And I ended up with a camera. I mean, yeah. I was shooting a second unit on that was unofficial on Death Race 2000.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. The
Frankenstein.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a little glimpse to those days that I think is a great glimpse. Paul Bartel, who was brilliant and knew he was making a dark comedy. If you guys are familiar with the original Death Race, David Carradine, Sly Stallone, I mean, back in the day. And Roger Corman came up to him in front of me. I happened to be there. I was just literally getting coffee. It was like a third AD. And I saw Roger Corman come up to Bartel, take his script, and rip about 20 pages out of the middle and say, now you're back on schedule.
Oh.
So being a smart kid, I waited till the drama was over and I said, hey, I can take one camera and those two people in that particular car and get all their dialogue for you. And he said, go do it. He was out of time.
Yeah.
And they used every frame I shot. I was shocked. And I thought, well, I probably can do that. I probably am able to do this. Hmm. So that was a turning point for me. Anyway, look, I was basically worked hard, coffee, second AD, first AD, production, probably Body Rock. I was probably a line producer by then. And I observed a story, an amazing script by Desmond Nucano about a 19-year-old kid in New York breakdancing. And by the time the studio was done, it was the very talented Lorenzo Lamas. It was a whole different kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I said, we're going to make the best movie we can out of this. But I learned to fight for your film. I learned as a director, you want to be cooperative, but if they lead you to do things you didn't intend that are really hurting the property, it's okay to stand up for it. Because if the movie actually fails, nobody comes back and says, oh gosh, we're sorry we led you down that path and didn't let you make a musical and turned it into something else. We're sorry, we'll give you another job. That never happens. The filmmaker has the responsibility to his cast and his audience to do a good film, even though you have to be flexible. Don't freak out. Don't tense up. Be open-minded. I've gotten great suggestions from people that were in charge of things. But the beauty and the terror of film is you can go 20 degrees off the mark and never recover, even in the editing room.
And you were a producer on another really dynamic film that's honestly one of my favorite films. Just a little dance competition movie called Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Yeah.
Sarah Jessica Parker, Helen Hunt.
Pretty much launched their careers. And I think at that point, Shannon Doherty had done Little House on the Prairie.
Shannon passed away.
I know, it makes me really sad.
Yeah.
She was, you know, everything to
She was She was a child.
Yeah.
I was a very young producer in those days, but the one of my jobs was to get her back on track, her and her mom, her stage mom, because she would kind of go off and we got along very well, and I would bring young Shannon Doherty back into the scene or whatever it might be. That was fun. I love dance. I did musicals in college. So I always had a Jones for that. And when we screened The Mask for New Line for the first time, Bob Shea was furious. He said, "We did not pay you to make a musical." He didn't realize the effect of that dancing. Can I say the whole story? They told me to cut all the dancing out of the film, all the singing and dancing out of The Mask. And I kept my cool, surprisingly, because I have my limits. I have witnesses. Frank Darabont was a witness to this. And I said, "We can do that." I go, "You know, we had negatives in those days. You own the negative. You own the negative, but in my contract, I get 2 test screenings. So we're going to test screen my version, and then I'll do whatever you want with, in fact, you can do it with an editor." And at least that was contractual, and the audience saved my ass. It was test screenings in those days, and the number one thing was the singing and dancing. So there was almost a Mask without Tina Carlisle's song, without Jim Carrey singing and dancing, whatever other jazz band things we had. Because it was a surprise. I mean, they read the script, I'm sure, but to see it be kind of big in the story the way we did it. So that was my secret musical and my secret superhero movie ahead of the superhero. I got to do 2 or 3 genres in one.
But it seems like you're ready for that moment because, as Heidi says, you'd produced another movie in that vein. And so the things you're learning as a producer when you're starting out that prepare you to be a director is you have to see every facet
I was my... close with my directors and writers. I believe in a team. You need a little team in the storm mm-hmm. of a film. I also believe in standing up for the film if the day comes. But because I was an assistant director, I was all about producers should support the director once we all sign off on the script and the casting, you know, where there can be, you know, lively debates as much as you want. Then it's time to shoot on a schedule. Remember this, producers out there, support your director, you know, give him the ammo he needs to get his day done every day. So I had good relationships with those directors and learned more from them because of that. And in Girls Just Want to Have Fun, we were a little bit hands off to a choreographer who was just a little bit of a diva. And when I saw the final dancing, I freaked out because I go, "Dude, I can take you to a nightclub Thursday night at midnight where you'll see wilder shit than this." So we were like shooting the next day and I called up a couple of gymnasts I knew through stunt people. So at the end of the dance numbers, and girls just want to have fun, all of a sudden you see these people do these triple flips and things with the doubles. And it helped because it's a whole movie about how good the kids were. And it was a comedy. But you know, you come in as a producer creatively in support, but it's okay if you have an epiphany that it's like, "We're going to have to reshoot a dance and we don't have the money. We got to get it tomorrow."
Nightmare on Elm Street 3, it's like one of the best sequels ever made. And it's, and especially over time, has become probably more beloved than the original.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm not breaking new ground by saying that, but like I still love the original because it's just one of the most imaginative, scary movies ever made. And I think Wes's lore is so brilliant, but like, you know, and the second's a really interesting movie in some ways, and maybe the missteps of making sequels. But then 3 comes back to this idea of something I think that's really special about your work, which is true imagination. You open up a whole world.
Thank you so much.
And then the imagination of all the characters in your movie is part of the world. And it's just really refreshing. But 2 things. How did you get the chance? And then when we're talking about magic and we're talking about staging, how did you learn, even before The Blob, which is, you know, truly extraordinary in that regard, but in Nightmare, there's so many moments. How did you learn how to shoot this stuff? Was it from the previous films? How did you just know, obviously trusting your DP and everything, but just talk us through the making of that first film.
Okay. You brought up a couple of interesting things. Yeah, two was a disappointment with respect to the filmmakers and the brilliant Robert Englund, who's amazing.
Yeah.
New Line was actually not sure they would continue. Mm. And I had brought The Blob to them. I had already written The Blob with Darabont. And I came to New Line and said, you know, I've done all this producing and assistant directing, and they had liked Dreamscape, which
oh, yeah.
I produced.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dreamscape.
And amazing. Dennis Quaid, Max von Sydow, and Christopher Plummer with 5 cents to make the movie with, but still, it was fun.
Yeah, watch how many times Plummer blinks in that movie. I pointed out, you know, because Michael Caine says don't blink, but Christopher Plummer is doing some really creepy shit in that film as the bad guy, and last time it was kind of unnerving in that film.
Well, thanks, and I'm just a big Max von Sydow fan.
Oh, yeah.
But my point is they'd seen that and but they didn't want to make The Blob. And they said, we're kind of thinking about making another Elm Street, but, you know, sell us on doing Elm Street and you can direct it. So I was drawing storyboards. They gave me Wes's script, and Darabont and I did a complete rewrite with respect to Wes and Bruce Wagner. We took it in a bigger direction. Where the big problem they had with it was that I had Freddie doing characters. He was in a tuxedo. Mm-hmm. He was coming out of a TV. He was doing stuff. They thought, well, that's going to be ridiculous. And I said, trust me, it's a dream thing, and it's going to be scary ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know. And so that if I have I trust myself in a tone where we don't. If you go too far, you'll never get suspense back. If the filmmakers try too hard to be funny, and I think some of the later Elm Street films tried a little too hard to just hit the punchlines so hard and things like that, you got to care about the kids. So, you know, Wes's brilliant concept of kids in an asylum is a big part of what made that work. And I went and volunteered in a halfway house for teens in Hollywood. Mm. And I actually brought a lot of that to the screenplay to try to get as deep as I could. So dare to go deep. And then get as crazy as dreams are and give Freddie even more personality and more backstory. The nun in Elm Street 3, I often look at the nun movies and go, where did they ever get that idea? Looks familiar, that skinny, high cheekbone nun. Yeah. And those are great films, but it's fun to be part of the procession, you know, in horror. So, anyway, that was really what it was all about is that. And I tell this to young filmmakers, it doesn't matter if you get that film made. You're presenting yourself to production people, film finance, whatever it is, as a director. And they will see you as a director if you speak well and have a good project. If they don't make your project, they might just do what happened to me, which is say, we don't want The Blob, but see if you can fix up the Little Red Wagon, and then you can drive the Little Red Wagon on Elm Street 3. And how did I know that stuff? I did a lot of stupid 8mm stuff. Mm-hmm. I had probably way too much confidence that what I would do would work. I did have a good DP, but mainly it was screenplay forward, which is why Darabont and I were so tight. It's like, you know, I wanted to think, I always do this. I wanted to write stuff I didn't know how to do. Because if you know how to do it, then you've seen it before, haven't you? So it's always about breaking it down. Don't be scared. There's a little, you know, David Copperfield in Practical Effects. It's a lot of fun as long as you make it safe because you can get people hurt. And no one ever got hurt with my stuff. But I never asked an actor to do something I wouldn't do, you know. There's always ways of doing it safely and creating an illusion, which I love. So even now on going back to Witchboard, I wanted to go back to Practical Effects. So what you're seeing is 90% Practical Effects, including this cat that does –
I love
wild, some wild stuff. And no double, just that cat was great. Like the dog in the mask, I'm very blessed with animals or something. Wait to see this cat. It's really nice. Tatiana, it's very unusual. But I did, practical effects are scarier almost always. And the element that you don't realize is the actors are scared shitless. Okay, so something happens because they know, in this case, Madison Eisman knows some hand's going to explode up out of the bed. And there's a real dudes in makeup she can't see grabbing her. All that was, you know, the whole, when you see the movie, the whole bedroom set was 8 feet in the air and the dump tank was real. None of that was all physical effects enhanced with CGI. So you still get I think fear is a herd instinct. And I think it starts right on camera. So I don't try to scare my cast, but there is the anticipation when I say action that they're going to get launched and something's going to happen. And I think it communicates to that moment in film. So as many of those effects are practical as they could be. And I just had a lot of fun going back into the practical effects world.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about magic, like close-up magic, which is, you know, obviously the kind that is most mind-blowing, I think that is, when I watch The Blob, I think that of all the films in terms of practical, I think it's one of the truly great pieces of, like, illusionary art, because there's just moment, I can quote to almost anyone here, like, five scenes where you're like, I had Tony Gardner on a podcast to break down how to do it, and I still don't believe
it. He was willing. He was like, willing to try.
I still don't understand it because it's like happening right in front of you. But like, how much of that do you have to believe early on to make sure it's believable and grounded so we believe as an audience? Like, at what point do you, especially with The Blob, where it could be ridiculous, the chance of that looking bad seems higher.
Yeah. No, I know.
Right?
I know. But I knew it would be better than the original.
Yeah, yeah.
So I felt,
you had that going.
I felt even in a lack of perfect success, it was a little bit of a low bar, but we did better than I thought. And I basically called everybody I ever met in the effects. Tony pulled it off.
Yeah.
And I believe it was Lyle Conway, who had done The Plant in Little Shop of Horrors, was my creature maker. But something really weird turned out. Beware of early tests, because there was a reverse test of The Blob that looked great that – turned out to be luck, and we could never recreate. So it was a big deal because I kept having to push The Blob scenes back. And this was still early enough in my career that, you know, my career was at some risk. And again, I support my team, including effects. And I kept pushing the scenes back and I said, don't worry, get it right. We'll wait. Then I turned around to, Kevin Yeager, right, and Tony and his makeup effects team. Literally, I had everybody. We ended up having to do every kind of blob. So we have large miniatures. I learned about large miniatures on that show. One of the great miniatures was a phone booth this tall.
Yeah, one of the best scenes ever.
The actress
Candy Clark.
Candy Clark is pounding on the phone, but it's like phone booth terror. And that was all. There was full scale, but there was a miniature where we put a bunch of blob material. We call them prom dresses. So they were actually silks pumped up with methicil, which they used to make milkshakes with in McDonald's. I don't know if they still do. It's a thickening agent. You can eat it. It's a thickening agent. And with the brilliant work of that team, we stuffed air mortars, which is what you shoot things with, full of these from four sides, looking straight down at a big miniature with a jointed doll in it. So check out that shot. It still blows my mind. Mm-hmm. It worked. The doll takes the impact, and it looks way better than CGI. You know, it's a heck of an exclamation point at the end of that scene.
There's just so many scenes like that, and the coming out of the pipe, you know, out of the drain.
Yeah,
just like I'm watching
that
it,
one
and I
was
still
easy
can.
For some reason.
Really,
but there were some that were way harder than we thought. But we didn't have a lot of time, and you learn to be fast on your feet. Some of the scenes we redesigned as we shot them, which you have to do. And the blob itself was so heavy, even medium large ones were just dead weight, really difficult to move. So we did a lot of in-camera reverse tricks and a lot of tilting sets, the car that takes the naughty guy in Lover's Lane out. I had a tilting car to do it with. So on a independent film budget, I'm very proud of what we did. And again, I always have no one got hurt, because I always am aware, and every filmmaker, please remember, your passion will make you go further. And there have been, you know, memorable accidents here and there over the years on big and small films. Just think it through. And I have stopped movies. I stopped one commercial when I was producing commercials, because I saw the cougar take a shot at the model, you know, and no one else saw it. But thankfully, the camera, one of the video cameras was rolling. You could see that. I wrapped the commercial. I said, we can't work. The nice cat, but we can't work with that cat. So our responsibility as directors, producers, and assistant directors is don't ask the cast to do something you wouldn't do. And I learned at a certain point in my career, on Eraser, I was standing on top of the train car. It's not a brag. It's a practical point. So when Arnold came on the big set at Warner Brothers, I said, you're here. So you can see what he's going to deal with. too many times as an assistant director on big action gags, I'd see the director going, to the left, to the left. And you're up there. I'm usually up there with spotting the actor as an assistant director. And I'm like, there is no left. You know, there's no left. It looks different to you. So, you know, take your time. There was danger, even when you're shooting car drive-bys, of distracting other cars. So you don't have to get paranoid, but just realize your passion may lead you to something that's edgy you don't have to do. Take a breath and come up with a safer way to do it, my advice. Yeah,
were you conscious with your career? I know some careers just unfold a lot of the times, but were you conscious to try to not get pigeonholed in one certain lane, especially after Blob? Were you trying to keep changing genre to genre?
I did that. I did that on purpose. Yeah. For one thing, horror, after a couple of years, even though it's only two films, I'd written other stuff, and I do what I ask my actors to do. We go there. You know, it's this old, you hypnotize yourself. Like, I think someone actually saw a ghost. I even think someone at some point actually saw what you might call a demon. You know, I want to go there, right? In my head, when we're writing, and especially when we're performing, and I tell my actors, if we're doing anything about possession or the Ouija stuff and all that, I tell them to take a few minutes and meditate on something good, whether it's a watch your dad gave you or a cross or whatever it is. If we're going through a tense screaming all day or something like that and imagining these things, then take a breath, balance yourself out, because days of that kind of stuff can get to you. So finally, I had a family member pass away right before the mask came up, and I really wanted to, I couldn't take it again. I besides the practical element that I thought was going to be too much like Freddy Krueger, I just really wanted to do comedy. And I'd done it as a producer. I wanted to do it as a director. Hmm.
But then even like through to, you know, as you're saying, talking about Eraser, it feels almost conscious at a point to keep switching genres to try something totally different.
You know, it's hard. I've learned it's hard, surprisingly, for anybody. I got to work with Michael Mann as a director. I like working as a producer as well. So on Collateral, I produced that with Darabont, and we got Michael Mann and Tom Cruise to come in. It's surprisingly hard for even the better-known directors to get exactly the project they want to shoot done when they want to shoot it.
Yeah.
Except the brilliant Jim Cameron, who just goes and takes everything to New Zealand and says, I'm going to be 10 years, but I'm going to come up with something you're going to like. Yeah. You know? So, you know, hats off to Jim. But most of us are kind of stuck because these films are so expensive. In the machinery of larger studio films, Ridley Scott got to make Napoleon and Kurt Russell. No, not Kurt Russell. The Shining, the director of The Shining.
Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, he wanted to do that movie for years and couldn't get it made. So how do you say no to Kubrick? But it happens. Kubrick got to do 100 takes, but he had to have a small crew so he could do 100 takes. Yeah. So it wasn't just the studio saying, go ahead, tell us when you're done. You know, the studio said, here's your budget. And he wanted to do 100 takes. So he said, how about 30 people instead of 200? And made it balanced. So at the end of the day, it's not easy. So what I guess my point is, I love action movies. I loved all those genres as a kid. So I really wanted to do horror, comedy, and action. And I'm blessed that I got to do all three and want to continue.
Kind of wrapping with coming back to Witchboard, did you have fun returning to horror genre? And speak a little bit about shooting here, because I didn't know
until
yesterday.
I love Montreal now.
Shot in Montreal.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. This is exciting to be right here with you folks. And I've been hearing about Fantasia Festival for years. So finally, it kind of all comes together for me. We shot here in Montreal. We finished just in time, and we're looking at, okay, the way we do independent films, where we actually continue to own the rights worldwide and are masters of our own fate, which is the best thing about independent filmmaking, then you have to kind of see what festival comes up just as we finally have all the opticals and everything finished. And Fantasia. I said, finally I get to do something here. And Mitch accepted our film. I still have to show the film and be judged. And fortunately for me, they liked it. So I'm excited to show it here. We have a lot of our cast and crew are locals and will be at the premiere with us.
Is the film set in Montreal, or is it set elsewhere and shot here?
It's set elsewhere.
Okay, yeah.
But the beauty about Montreal is, as you said, we have some flashbacks, and there's amazing 300-year-old buildings here, including dungeons and a fort. I mean, we had to do set dressing, but things I thought for sure we'd have to build. I mean, that courtyard where the witches burn is the real thing. I was in heaven with that and with a great crew, and everyone spoke French. So I thought, why are my flashbacks in English? It's going to be corny to have people saying, don't kill me, I'm not a witch, you know, in English. It's quite a bit more amazing in French, at least as an American. So I said, let's set it all in the 1700s France. That was the worst abuse of witches anyway. So we have quite a bit of fun. You'll see if you like the flashback elements. But I will guarantee you the flashbacks are part of the story through line. It's always moving forward. I don't like flashbacks where it's like, back in the day, and you don't have to worry because obviously whatever happened is over. Mm-hmm. The flashbacks are part of the continuing action that I hope challenges the viewer to see where the story's going.
And do you think you'd come back to Har again after this, doing this one?
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed myself. I have some more ideas.
Cool. Well, we really appreciate you coming to talk. It's great. Everyone go see Witchboard tomorrow at 9 o'clock, 9:15?
9:45. They put it late, and I go, well, it's a horror film. Let's do it, you know?
Yeah. No, but we really appreciate getting to talk to you about some of this stuff. And
I love it. I love talking to people who enjoy the genre, and we've got a terrific audience. So to me, this is a little bit like coming home back to the horror genre.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, well, thank you. A big round of applause.
You want me to switch?
Yeah, we'll switch. Okay. You can hop out for this part because we're doing.
Oh, you're doing
the non-interview part. Don't worry.
Okay.
This is a boring part.
Okay. Yeah. So am I off?
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks again.
Oh, and that way we can look at each other.
I mean, we're not saying you have to leave, Chuck. You just, you know. No, we're not forcing you.
Yeah, no, we're done with you.
This is just going to be more awkward if you're sitting there, probably. Yeah.
We're just letting you off the hook so you don't have to hear the rest of it if you don't want.
We're going to talk about your other films. You're just going to watch. Okay. All right. So our show, we interview people, and we had a theme. And Becca's the person who always makes the PowerPoints. So it was 1 a.m. last night, and I was at the bar down the street realizing I didn't have a PowerPoint because I'd sent all the materials to Becca. And I was like, oh, Christ, we have to still do a show. So we're going to do pretty much the same stuff we were going to talk about, which was we're going to talk about some favorite – like one thing about the 80s that has been lost for sure, and especially on streamers. I think companies like Vinegar Syndrome and Severin are trying to bring it back for sure. It's the tactile quality of the art of VHS, the fact that there's two sides to this thing. Like, people always talk about the covers, but man, when you would turn that thing over, it was mesmerizing to a young, you know, cineast, or even if you weren't deeply into movies. I think it was a big reason why a lot of us got so into this. So we thought it'd be fun to run through a few of our favorite VHS covers, the less obvious ones. Obviously, Nightmare on Elm Street and things like that are incredible. So we're going to do a little bit of that. We're going to talk about – Heidi has an incredible book we're going to ask her about and part in some panels. And then we're going to end something that me and Becca kind of – the thing I think that really makes – us keep doing this, you know, when you do anything like this for 10 years, outside of meeting interesting people and hearing great stories, you know, what keeps you going is discovery. And for us, we call it deep cuts. There's a million terms, right? But for us, it's like we will start talking and we start to try to one-up each other with crazy shit that the other person hasn't seen. And we're always like blown away that we're like 12 years deep into doing this stuff and we are not even close to having seen all the interesting cinema, right? So at the end, we're just going to both give you five deep cuts. Heidi's are going to be a little different because they're also coming. I asked her to pick five that came from her actual book. So but like female-directed, interesting films off the beaten path a little. So hopefully this will still work. Sorry, my slideshow is really not as exciting as Becca's would have been. She's so much better, but I can push a button. So all get right. ready. Yeah.
So I found out young people don't say PowerPoint presentation. Oh. Did you know
what
that?
What do they say?
They say slideshow. So you just said slideshow. So that's good. But I was shocked. I was like, what do you mean PowerPoint? And no, it's just want you to know that. I learned that. I'm terribly upset because I call it PowerPoint presentation.
Well, and it's not even a PowerPoint. Yeah. Like on here, the thing I'm building, it's not even called PowerPoint. So yeah. I don't even know what it's called. But that's not the fun part. So we're going to just run through some. If you really like one, like this is the interactive part. Like if it's one from your childhood that you did, you know, maybe you can meow. I don't know. I think that's a thing here I've noticed. That was a nice fun, whatever you want to do. I'm going to start with one from Canada. This is not one. Most of these, I try to pick ones that got me excited when I was young, when I was a kid. This one I didn't discover until I think I was 20, but oh, wait, this is the precursor. Curtains is fucking crazy. Yeah, this movie, the weird meaty quality to the drapes of this image and a doll. And then, of course, what if you've seen the movie, the best thing in the whole movie is just the old hag mask on the on ice skates. It's really mesmerizing. Other parts of this movie are a little clunkier at times. It's a group of women auditioning for a new film by a director who is secretly trying to put one of the actresses into a psychiatrist, into an asylum to get rid of her. And then there's a slasher killing people. It's a very strange story, but this is the kind of art that just this just doesn't happen anymore. Like, you know, people who make an independent film can get this kind of stuff through still, but like something that will really grab you, it feels transgressive. There's like this innocent childlike thing between something that just feels like it's going to swallow us whole. And then you get a taste. I just wanted on some of these to give you guys a taste for those who weren't there picking up these items, just to see how sometimes it was the back, you know, and these little exploitive, you know, blurbs that would just make your brain. I mean, if you have to think, if you're 10 or 12 and your parents, like in the 80s, parents were not watching kids at all. Like whatever you wanted to bring home is like, as long as there's five and it's $10 for the weekend, you're in, you know, and it really kind of made a bunch of maniacs. There's like a whole generation of people who are just obsessed by film for these reasons. Did you see this one at the time?
Yes, I did. And the ice skating scene. If you haven't seen it, just watch it for that. I have to be honest, the rest of the movie doesn't make sense, but the rest of the movie doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
But it's super fun and create weird ice skating. It's worth it.
Yeah.
Just even.
And John Vernon, anything John Vernon appears in the 80s is just a little bit better. He's like the Michael Ironside. We're just talking today. The Michael Ironside effect that like any movie he's in, even if it's one scene as a cop, you're like, yeah, that's a little bit better now. Because he's serious no matter what the tone of the movie. I don't think I've ever seen him like just goofing, you know? Okay, so Heidi's first pick. Heidi might have a theme.
I might have a theme. So...
And you missed a hell of a movie last night, by the way. Frankie Frico. It's like they made a movie for you, as you'll see at the end of this.
I'm so sad to have missed that.
You'll make it up.
I will make it up. So this is funny because A, it has a toilet. And B, there's a little monster coming out of the toilet, right? So this is the running gag in the Ghoulies films, is that creature coming out of the toilet. Like, he's kind of an amphibious demonic creature, so he prefers being in the water. And of course, if you sit on the toilet when he's in it, he will bite you in the butt, which is also very funny. At least, I mean, when I was a kid and rented this film and saw it, I thought that was absolutely hilarious. And I think that was the target audience, because when you watch it as an adult, you're more like, well, toilet. But, you know, it's really quite funny if you're six or nine. But I have a really soft spot in my heart for the Ghoulies movies. I'm very fond of little tiny monsters. Gremlins was one of my favorite movies as a kid. There's just something so fun about little evil things.
Well, and they're not in the first one enough. That's everyone's complaint.
True.
It's had the best poster, best VHS cover, but then you watch the movie and they hardly are in it. It's mostly a guy with sunglasses who's a Satanist, and you're like, wait,
that's
where's
true.
The Ghoulies?
Part two has a lot more Ghoulies in it.
A lot more Ghoulies.
And a lot more. I think part two is better than part one.
Yeah, we had Charlie Band on the show once, and he did talk about that he got the most angry letters from parents because this cover traumatized a whole generation who couldn't go to the bathroom by themselves anymore.
Yes.
Because they thought and he said it was a real problem that helped their sales, so he didn't care. But, you know, it's a parent's problem. All right, we'll keep it going because we're going to hit this area again. One of my favorites. I talked about this a lot, but I think and maybe it was different in Canada too. When I, so I was mostly raised in New Zealand during this period, and, Society was as big as Reanimator was there. There was no difference. It was just R and then S on a shelf. And then I came to America years later, and I, at that time, struggled to find anyone who knew about Society, and it wasn't available for a long time. And I started to wonder if it was just an availability issue. It definitely fell out at one point. But the practical, when we're talking about like the Blob, I'd put this up there. We're Screaming Mad George doing something with imagination, something that Pornhub couldn't even come up with at the end of this thing with the shunting. You're just like, whatever is going on. But it has a comedic tone, so it's a very strange satire. It works as a satire, but the cover, again, it's like about the intrigue that we get from the cover. I think the cover that I was raised on was this one initially, but I just wanted to show both because they're great, because it is about a high-class, like, at the end, it's high-class society that you're trying to be a part of, but they're also these creature, blue-blood characters. And, you know, if you told me I'd fall in love with a Billy Warlock from Baywatch movie at that time, I would have been like, yeah, no way. But in a way, he's kind of perfectly cast as kind of a jock himbo who's not just not part of the elite. If you haven't seen this film, I know now almost everyone's caught up to it at this point. It is really singular. Like, even compared to something like Reanimator, as wild as that is, this is going in such a strange, dark, messed up thing. I imagine you go to sleep to this one. Just have Heidi going to sleep to The Shunt.
No, this is a fantastic film, and I love anything that has social satire of any kind, dark or light. And this is definitely one of the better social satire horror films of the 80s, for sure.
Yeah, and again, you know, and these posters and these designers have to get the essence of something. And I think with this, especially this one here, you're just absolutely nailing what you're going to get without repulsing someone to not want to look at it. I think this film would be, if you look at the back cover, that's for the darker folks. Okay, here is Heidi's next one. The theme is alive.
So as you can see, you have a toilet. And you have the same creature coming out of the toilet again, but he's got a friend, right? And so that lets you know that this is one of the rare cases, as you know, maybe Nightmare on Elm Street 3, maybe, where the sequel is more enjoyable in some ways than the original, right? Uh-huh. So you have more ghoulies, and this one's great because they are at a carnival, and they sneak into the dark ride at the carnival, and people go in the ride thinking that they're little puppets that are part of the carnival, but they're not. They're demons that got conjured, and it's a whole thing, and it's really wonderful. And so after I saw Ghoulies, I went and rented Ghoulies 2, which I loved even more. So
where do they go after this? Just tell everyone. Do you remember where they go after this film?
For part 3?
Yeah, do you remember? Ghoulies go where?
Ghoulies.
They're helping. College.
Oh God, that's right.
It came up. I'm only asking because last night at the Frankie freakout, that he was saying this was his Ghoulies go to college. So it is so made for you. I can't wait for you. But the next one is not 3. She breaks her theme a little.
I broke the theme a little bit.
It's gonna stay. Yeah.
No toilet.
All right. I'm going over to some Ozploitation. There's a few covers for this, but I love this cover. It's just like, the movie has like one of the best 8-minute kind of opening scenes where a giant silverback boar literally destroys an entire house and kills everyone inside, and it's pretty wild. But I just like the kind of big swing with the kind of drawings. Without even knowing what this is about, I'm in. Whatever this movie's going to be, there's some sort of hunter, there's a house on fire, and there's a giant boar. And somehow the film still delivers this. Maybe not quite as good as the poster, this one, but the director who directed Highlander is a real stylist. And I think this was his first feature, and I think really nailed down some stuff. Have you seen Razorback? This is like,
yeah, I have,
okay.
Yeah.
Like this
I love, yeah,
it's
animal, evil animal movies are the best.
Yeah, animal attacks. Yeah. And that's this feels like we're representing Becca because she's an animal attack advocate. So, okay, moving on back to the theme.
Okay, so Critters, right? So, Critters, the first Critters is honestly one of my favorite weird horror sci-fi movies ever. It's so funny and it's absolutely hilarious. And so this cover, you get to see some detail on the critter that you don't necessarily get to see in the film. So that's nice because they move really quickly. They roll up like little balls and they shoot around. But they're adorable and they have their own language. And they put little translations under so you can understand what they're saying to each other. But they're criminals from outer space. And they're pod or somehow they end up on Earth accidentally. And the bounty hunters that are after them come to Earth as well and take on the form of like a Duran Duran-esque band. and it's totally out there, but it works somehow for me. And it's got Dee Wallace, which is great. Scott Grimes, if you guys are Scott Grimes fans,
He's going to come up again at the end of this episode, so that's cool.
Yeah, so he's currently, well, I don't know if they're currently making any more Orville episodes, but he was on the Orville. He is in this as a little kid, and he's absolutely hilarious. And I think I actually started my crush on him from watching this movie, and it's still there. So if you see him, tell him I said hi.
I like that you made eye contact with me for that. Like I'm going to talk to him. I think of, for me, it was like one of the first times seeing little things swear.
Yes.
That was so exciting. When they have weapons. Fuck. It's just like so great. Like just, and you're right. Again, kind of back to what we're saying about Chuck's work. This movie had imagination. Like it's not just, you know, there's some of these little creature movies that are just feel like exploitation movies with little creatures. This felt much more of a whole world. Also kind of a little bit like Fred Decker's work.
Yeah.
Fred's stuff is always so full of life and a little bit of magic too.
Yeah. It's fun and the humor is smart and silly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. This is one that I am like, I think somebody could just make that image, the killer in any movie, and you're just going to be terrified. Tourist Trap, I think is really a great film on its own. It's a really interesting exploitation film. But the imagery on this, it's one of the few covers that I actually find slightly chilling because I can't place it. I don't know if that's a person, a mannequin. There's like a lot of mannequins in this movie, and there's something unsettling about being photographed. Everything about the design of this, it's probably the kind of tape I might not have rented one day because I would have put it back down. Like, yeah, no. Like at that point. But I've come to really love this film, and it has a couple scenes that almost get as good as this image. You know, maybe not quite, but it gets damn close. So
that image is nightmare fuel completely.
Yeah, Dead and Buried's another way. Like there's just a few movies that have something like that. The kind of uncanny masks that we get sometimes are too much. But really great movie, underrated, and kind of sometimes gets, I think, less talked about in the shuffle of all these films. Because, again, another thing that got lost, you know, obviously you guys are all here, probably know this, but, you know, there's still movies that haven't made it from VHS. There's not as many because we have these great companies, you know, restoring, but there, I find a few every year that I fall in love with that are really lost movies effectively because they're on a format that no one outside of a few collectors are still watching on VHS. So, sorry, this is a biggie.
Yeah, so Puppet Master, the first in the series, is one of my favorites in the series because, and I can say that because there's like 14 of them now or something. But so this is one of my favorites in the series. And I chose this because, again, I love little evil things. And this was truly a film that I did pick up as a kid in the warehouse, which was a store for all of the young people here who don't know what that is, that rented VHS to people like me, and I popped it in the VHS and I watched it, and it's absolutely horrific in so many ways. Like there are these cute little things, and they're kind of, I mean, they're cute, but they're also weird looking sometimes, but they are just deadly and also very sympathetic. Like they're not just, you know, pure evil for evil's sake. They're actually little personalities. And this film launched, you know, as I said, 14 sequels, I think. So, I have a really big soft spot for it. Much better. There's another film called Dolls. That's also
Stuart Gordon,
full moon. And I like that too, but if you have to put them up against each other, I will always pick Puppet Master. Mm. I just think there's so many things that they did with the story to expand it over the years that it's, I know. I mean, obviously they ended up like in the Third Reich or whatever, but you know,
they made some mistakes along the way.
And they actually stopped using, there's some really beautiful stop motion animation in at least the first five of them. And I think that kind of got too expensive or whatever. So they stopped. But the stop motion is actually like stunning in this film. So.
Yeah. And aside on podcasting, if you're thinking about starting a podcast, don't. But if you do, this is what I was doing at 2 a.m. last night. I was going picking Heidi's pieces because I had to quickly put this together. And I'm sitting at 2 a.m., pull this poster down. I'm like, I don't know if it does it justice. I think I need a cross-section of just a close-up of their faces. At 2:20, I'm still trying to crop this image. And I'm going, what the fuck am I doing with my life? I need to go to sleep. Yeah. That's podcasting, just to give you behind the scenes. All right. Moving on. Okay, this is my number one.
Ooh.
And I say that because you're Canadian, and that's it. I just was hoping to get some. No,
that's beautiful.
This is it's one of my favorite movies. Still, sadly, a little lost in the shuffle. But there's a couple different versions. The one that I really find mesmerizing. It's like that one, but it's even further up the stairs. There's a perspective, and this is a movie mostly famous for the central image there of the pin of this like plastic anatomy doll, but the fact that it's not on the cover is really important because sometimes we lead with these money shots or whatever, you know, and it's like, but once that's out there, like Long Legs is a great example because they didn't do that and it pays off when you watch the movie, when you discover what Nicolas Cage looks like and some of the other things in that film. This is showing so much restraint, and yet I think I was so much more mesmerized to want to see this movie because I didn't know what was at the top of the stairs, and I don't know what's under that cover. And it's a really smart, really unsettling, coming-of-age, disturbed young man film that by Sandra Stern. And just I in this country, I'm sure it's not underrated, but I think in the States, it's still heavily unseen, and it's really a creepy, effective movie. And I just think this, again, it shows you sometimes our design to step away and let our let the imagination of us, the consumer, in a little more. Have you seen Penn?
I have not, but I see that it's a Pierre David produced film, which is always
which makes sense. Yeah. David Hewlett, and the guest of the fest coming up, Vincenzo Natali, who gets an award in a couple of days. I remember talking to him once, and David Hewlett was his high school friend. They were friends at high school, the lead in this film, and then would go on to be in all their – he's in most of his films, Cube, obviously. But anyway, Penn, so everyone, hands up who's seen Penn, just so I get a sense. Okay, so it's still – Penn's still ripe for discovery. This is great. Penn, and Terry O'Quinn, by the way. Terry O'Quinn, the stepfather, which is also a great movie, is – incredible in this film as the guy basically teaching his children about sex. They'll come to his office, he's a doctor, and he'll say, well, I won't talk to you, but Penn will. And it just cuts to this mannequin that he then like is ventriloquistly throwing sexual advice, and it's just like, what is, your kids are so screwed now, you know? Yes, you do it like that. I mean, it's just, anyway,
that sounds horrifying.
Don't do what Terry O'Quinn does. Anyway, okay, and this is your last Steve.
Okay. So this could actually have fit in the next list you had me put together as well. So Munchies is a really low budget Gremlins ripoff movie. So as I said before, when I was a kid, Gremlins was amazing, right? And back then you had to wait like a year for a movie to come out on VHS. Like it would be in theaters and then it was gone and you could not see it. It wasn't on TV, on any of the three channels. And so while I was waiting, I think, for Gremlins, I saw this. Even though this came out,
this is the second one, right? There's like a Munchie, or is that
no?
Different?
This is the first one, but I think it may have had a small run in drive-ins, but I think it was mostly a straight to video.
Right, probably. Yeah.
And what's funny is I rented it because I was like, oh, it's like Gremlins. It's really terrible, right? And there that scene, like the weird Marilyn thing, like that's not in the movie. It's just absolutely sleazy and just an attempt to get people to pick up the video case. But what I love about this movie is it's directed by a woman, by the way. As I was researching this film for my book, I was talking to Joe Dante because I was asking him about it. I was like, it's basically a Gremlins ripoff. What do you think? And he was like, well, it turns out the director was actually a friend of his. Mm. And she approached him and she was like, hey, I really want to make a Gremlin ripoff. And he said, absolutely, whatever you need. And so he helped her out a lot. I think she may have edited it on his editing bay. And he was just a big supporter of her. And so when I got that story, I was like, this is great. So then I was like, I need to talk to her. And I finally got a hold of her and I was like, I really want to talk to you about your movie. And she was like, no, I want to forget that movie ever existed. And so unluckily, Bettina Hirsch did not speak to me about her movie. But that cover and the fact that I was so disappointed by it once I rented it as a child will never leave me. So.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole nother show. And Becca, I was trying to get Becca to do the VHS covers we rented that, like movies we hated, but we kept renting it like multiple times. There was like Blood Beach, me and my writing partner back there make jokes about that film all the time. It has like the best post art ever, but the movie just is a slog once you get into it. But that'd be going negative. But I will say, like doing stuff with the New Beverly in LA, there are so many guests who feel that way about their film because they haven't seen them since they came out. Yeah. And I bet you if that played and she came and then she saw that people love it genuinely.
That would be awesome.
It's special when you see that. Deb Brock had done that and, you know.
She's a good sport.
Yeah.
I don't know. It might be worth a shot if you can. I think there is a print of Munchies that was restored by Vinegar Syndrome.
I don't think I've ever seen Munchies. It's like I know the cover. I think it's one of those movies I never actually watched. So.
Just think like low budget Gremlins and not funny.
Okay. Sold. You.
That's probably why she didn't want to talk to me, right? Olivia, can I talk to you about your film? No, I don't want to talk to you. You just said about my film. Anyway, we can move on.
Okay, we're going to move to this is a musical interlude. If this was a podcast, okay. So you have a book. I Spit on Your Cellulite. Tell us a little bit about it and, sure. and a couple of the events coming out of it that are happening here.
Yeah, so this is my first time at Fantasia, by the way. So I've always wanted to come. And the first time I get to come here, I actually have a book release. So I'm stoked. Right, like, this yeah. is amazing for me. This is like probably peak. Like, I thought I peaked in like 2007, but I think I'm actually peaking now. So that's yeah, yeah. that's pretty good.
That's good.
So I'm super excited. This book is about women directing horror movies. It's something that I've been working on for a very long time. I started researching it many years ago, longer than I'd like to admit.
And I wonder if we should give some shading if people don't know you, because you also are one of the founders of Etheria.
Yeah, I run a short film festival called Etheria. Sometimes we show a feature,
yeah.
But more often than not, we should just show a short selection of short films. And right now, or for the past couple of years, we've been showing them on Shudder. They're actually on Shudder right now, the 2024 films. You can go watch them. They're all really good. And that's the thing, is they're all really, really good. And that's what we pride ourselves on in our, that's why there's so few of them. We just show the really, really great ones. And it's the best horror, sci-fi, fantasy, action and thriller films directed by women.
And it's been, so, and that's, I mean.
We're in our 11th year.
Yeah, when I first got to LA, yeah. I think you guys were maybe a year in. And
yeah.
I still think to this day, one of the best, when they played Slut.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's one of the best, like, graduating films.
Oh, so
Chloe
good.
Chloe Okuna made it out of AFI, and now yeah. she's doing some pretty big yeah. projects right now. And
yeah.
It's an incredible film.
Oh, yeah. We've had a lot of people show their film, and then they go on to be really big. And then I'm like, oh, she was in our festival.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, I will always promote them, because yeah. I'm also really proud of any of our filmmakers that do go on to do stuff, and a lot of them have. Like, Gigi Guerrero has, mm-hmm. like, yeah. we showed one of her short films in 2010. I think it was actually her first short film. And now she's has this amazing career directing for Blumhouse, and she's actually moving into other genres now. I know she just did a musical biopic
oh, cool.
in Mexico. Yeah, she's amazing. So anyway, that's what I do. And so my whole life has basically been immersed in the world of women directing genre films for at least 15 years, maybe more like 20. And there's a whole impetus and story about where this book came from and stuff. And I'm sure I will talk about that
yeah,
at this festival. But long story short, it came from I saw a need to tell a story that hadn't really been pieced together in one place before. So there's a lot of books on women directors. There's a lot of books about particular women directors, but I couldn't find the information that I wanted to find in one place. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to try to do that. And this is my attempt at putting together an actual history of women making horror movies from the beginning of film, which is about 1896. And then the book kind of ends at around 2020 because you have to end it. Otherwise, you just keep writing it forever and ever, right? There's no end. Like, I already see things. Every day I see some new stuff, and I'm like, oh, that would have been great to be in the book. But, you know, maybe in 10 years I'll do another edition or something.
Well, it also feels like the kind of thing that would make a great documentary too.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I actually have been developing it. It wasn't planted, but it should have been. I actually have developed a documentary out of this that I have, and I'm looking for people to talk to about it. So if there's anyone here at the festival that has any questions about it. But yeah, I would love to make this into a documentary. I think there's a lot of things that are lost and hidden about women making horror movies, especially in the past. I think that movies that women made were often not considered horror, even though they were, because it's considered not, it wasn't appropriate for women pioneers to be making those kinds of films. And so they often get pushed to the side. And I think that, yeah, we've had a big problem with sexism, you know, in the world in the last century. And there's been all kinds of technology changes and television and the sexual revolution and civil rights movement, all these things that affected film on so many different levels for men too, and also affected film for women. So it's really the story of how horror movies evolved in the greater context of the world of film in general.
Exciting. So just let the specific crowd know, when are the events? Just so
So tomorrow at 5:15, I am the official book launch is then, and I'm introducing a film called Hollywood 90028.
That film,
Christina Hornacher. Yeah,
I saw it on a VHS right before it got the re-release.
Yeah, right.
So I didn't know it was coming, and it has an ending that I still, again, breathtaking.
And the
film. Yeah.
And I had to see it the same way when I was first looking for this film. It was not available. You had to get like a bootleg of a VHS that was made in England in like 1985. That was the only way to see the film until Grindhouse Releasing actually restored the print, and now there's this beautiful HD release, and it's shot. When I first watched it, I was like, oh, but then when I saw the release, I was like, oh my God, like it actually is pretty looking. And I had no idea it looked pretty because you couldn't see any of the colors. It's set in Los Angeles, and it's really like a big love letter to Los Angeles.
Kind of like a Hillside Strangler meets Chantal Ackerman.
Yes, it is very much that. It's very much an art film as well as a sleazy serial killer movie.
Yeah.
So I'm introducing that, and I'm very happy to be doing that. And then on Saturday, I have put together this giant panel of like way too many women directors who are here. And we're all going to sit together in front of an audience. And this happens at 4 p.m. on Saturday. And we're going to go through and talk to each of these women directors individually and find out their story. Because one thing that I like about my book is I feel like it tells the story of a lot of individual filmmakers, how they made their film, why they made their film. It's not really an academic critique of films. I don't say films are good when they're not. Mm-hmm. It's really about why and how and behind the scenes. And so to me, those are the stories that are the most fun to hear. Like the one we heard today, those stories.
Yeah.
And I want to hear those stories from the women that are on this panel. And I hope you guys do too. So that's what we'll be doing at the panel. And we'll have books and we're going to sign them. And the women directors are going to be signing the book too, because that way it makes it more special.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm glad it worked out. Heidi was literally on a plane 45 minutes before this podcast started. So the fact that she stepped into this and we've been doing this without seeing has been pretty awesome. So to not take too much longer of your time, because I know there's a lot of events, we're going to do a fast version. These are five recs each that we'll give you. We won't spend long on them. Just for the, like, I don't know. You guys might not care, but I love when somebody just throws out a few films and one of them I might not have heard of and I write it down and then 17 months later I watch it because it takes me forever to remember. But I love that feeling of discovery. So we're just going to chart through so you guys can get to the next thing and we'll go film by film. This one I had not ever heard of.
Okay.
And when you gave me the title, I was typing in going, wow, cool.
Yeah. So Giovanna Lenzi is one of the first modern horror film directors from Italy. This film.
Any relation to Umberto Lenzi? Or
no.
Oh, interesting.
No. Huh. That would have been cool though. Mm. But no, she, this is actually a made for TV horror movie, which were very big in the 70s, 80s, 90s, all over Europe, just like they were in Europe. I mean, in the US. Sorry, just got off a plane. And it is super weird. It's very much it's like a low budget TV giallo. And the killer likes to squirt acid on people's faces. Mm. And they have the worst special effects to show like the acid. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't look like anything. It's really funny. But the rest of the movie is really well shot and really like a cool kind of story. So if you appreciate Italian horror movies, this is one. And I really liked the poster art because I thought it looked really classy.
Mm-hmm. The one I couldn't find a good image of.
Yeah, I think they're both kind of classy, to be honest. You know, they're like anytime you have like a painting, you know, I think that's pretty awesome. And it really, really gives you an idea of the tone of the movie. So.
Yeah, no, I'd never heard of this one, so that was exciting. Okay, you're talking about Scott Grimes. And Scott Grimes stars in this movie. And this movie, I hadn't heard of it till I do a different podcast for the New Beverly Cinema in LA called Pure Cinema. And my co-host of that for years was telling me about a movie called Nightlife. And I was just like, I don't know what that is. And I saw it recently, and I felt like if you love Monster Squad, this feels like this character is that one of the Monster Squad kids like 3 years later. He's just a little bit older, a little bit out of coming age. He works at his uncle's morgue or funeral home played by the Addams Family, the main Addams Family guy from the show. And one night, the bullies from high school, who are all like kind of terrorizing him at school, they all get in a car accident. And so all their bodies are shifted to where he works, and he's there at night. And then suddenly lightning hits, and they all come back to life. And it's actually like, it's a funny Fright Night style movie, but it's actually pretty disturbing and scary when they're coming for him, because they truly mean him harm. And it's almost got a mean spirit to that side of this film. And it was, this film is just, again, it's like totally neglected. There is no good release. And it to me, it felt like I was watching some classic from that period, but it's just, again, under-discussed. And
that sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's really fun. And I think it's something you were talking about just a second ago, which is things like, what is it, Beverly 902? What's the Strangler movie that you're introducing?
Oh, Hollywood 90028.
Yeah, the other thing that's under-discussed with companies that restore this stuff is that, like, there are people's voices that are lost otherwise, or they're in some old format that is hardly viewable. Yeah. But when somebody restores that, it's like that whole person's point of view and voice is restored for people to rediscover and realize, oh, like, women were making movies of a very interesting high quality. They just, a lot of them had just gone lost at times. Right. So anyway, these are important things to keep alive. In my opinion, this is a bit of a gem, to be honest. So definitely Monster Squad fans, Nightlife.
Oh yeah. Okay, so Rocktober Blood. This is a rock and roll horror film, right? And it's about a guy in a band, and he dies, and he comes back, and people are dying, and they're like, man, it's him. And it's got some of the worst, best music. Like that fake rock and roll, you know, like when people who don't know anything about music are like, we need a rock and roll song. And you're just like, wow, that's a gasong, you know? And it's like don't all the musicians have mohawks now or whatever? And they just have no idea what they're talking about. So it's got that, like, my mom made a rock movie kind of feel to the music. But it's, and it doesn't really, it's not really well made, but it's fun. It's a super fun movie to watch, and it keeps you guessing till the end about whether something supernatural is happening or whether something else is happening, and we've been duped. So
I told her before the show, I only saw this recently, and it's the only film in my adult life where I actually clutched my pearls in a moment because of one line. And if I say the line out loud, everyone's going to take photos of me and put the quote on, put it on Instagram and get me canceled. So I'm not going to do it. But it's truly one of those lines where I had to rewind the movie 5 times because I couldn't believe. So, well, I think it'd be better coming from Heidi. I really think it'd be stronger.
I want you to say it.
But it's just about somebody calling somebody and somebody saying, I want your hot steaming something blood all over my face. And it was one of those things that where you literally go, did that just happen in a movie?
Yeah.
And it did. And yeah. This is your pick. So yeah. Not my pick, your pick.
And Ferd and Beverly Sebastian also made a couple other movies together. They made Gator Bait.
Oh, Gator Bait's
fun. You guys
fun.
Are Gator Bait fans. And they made, and I think Beverly directed Gator Bait 2.
Oh, cool.
So
is she in your book?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
So all the films are mentioned, but you talked to some of them too. Okay, Rocktober Blood. Again, this finally got a Blu-ray, so I almost probably could stop talking about it now, but I just love this. Quite a few people who have caught up to it because of me have said they didn't like it. Maybe it doesn't work. It's really well shot. It's a very sleazy movie in the Hollywood Hills. A guy basically talks into his wife into saying, I need an artist retreat to do my writing and I should rent a room somewhere else. And you're cool with that, right? And then he goes there and basically just uses it to have an affair with multiple women. But the people renting the room to him turn out to be kind of, there's a vampire thing going on, and it's really sleazy and really dark, and it's shot by the director of The Hitcher, is the cinematographer on this, and The Hitcher is one of the best shot movies, period. It's just so well made, and there's these long take, like, tracking shots and just things that are surprising in this movie, and it was trapped on VHS until this year, and finally, I believe it's Vinegar Syndrome, finally put it together so people can see it. I've loved this one for years because it just feels a little taboo and adult, and not the kind of movie that I probably would have been allowed to, well, I would have been allowed to rent, but then, you know, I would have regretted
it. Sleazy Hollywood films are awesome.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. You know, Ty West has been bringing that back, obviously. So, okay. Great cover.
All right.
Look at that.
So, Roberta Finley is one of the best, worst filmmakers in the world. And by best, worst, I mean her films are questionable sometimes, but she's so funny and candid. And she started making films in, like, the 60s when she was 16 and ran away from home with her crazy husband. And then kept making films, and she's still alive in New York, somewhere. And so this is one of this is, in the 1980s, she branched out from basically doing horror porn to doing like action horror and straight horror, trying to actually make some money. And this was a film that she made set in a one building that she had access to in New York. So they shot the whole movie in the building, and therefore it's called called Tenement. And it's about like violent gangs breaking into a tenement building and the people who live there fighting back. And so it gets very violent. And it was too violent to be rated.
Yeah, I love that part.
So if you went to the VHS store and you wondered, that was like right on there.
But
and you
not
were like,
too
wow.
violent to be rented. You're just like, boom. Yeah. This is also coming off Warriors and all these movies about gangs.
Yeah.
Now this one grabs you straight away. Okay, this one's still, because it was an ABC TV movie, if people are looking for the best, like outside of Halloween, the best movie to watch at Halloween, this might be the best kept secret still. And I think the only reason maybe it hasn't had a Blu-ray is maybe music rights. Some of them are questionable, but it's an incredibly charming small town. It's one of those towns that is kind of founded on historical legends of all the Civil War kind of Confederate shops and stuff that kind of show the history. And one day, basically, these kids go into a graveyard. They do some mischief, and the dead start coming back. But it's not just the zombies. They're coming back almost, it's more like as souls or ghosts, because they're just going about their back to their lives and the things they were doing. And there's also vampires, and there's this like really cute story where basically one of the guys in the contemporary story starts falling for this like cheerleader he meets that night, but she's actually from the 1950s, and so she's got this very innocent minded character, and they start having this super cute romance, and it has character people, you know, from the cast of 21 Jump Street in it, and like it's just got a lot of kind of
LeVar Burton
and the DeLuise, and Sherry Belafonte is on it. It's just one of those movies that a friend showed me a couple years ago, and I could not believe that this wasn't a film that I had seen and that was like a classic for Halloween. So I know people are always looking for a great Halloween discovery, and I think Midnight Hour is terrific. And probably on YouTube, there's probably a good version of this right now. Fun movie. Yeah.
Okay.
Great cover.
So Slumber Party Massacre 2 is just absolutely hilarious and silly, and it has lots of really bad, good music in it. And I love this cover because it's mimicking the cover of the first one, which was a lot more serious. This is almost like a parody, video or photo shoot that you would put together as a joke to make fun of the first movie. And it's legit though. And the killer really does have a guitar with a drill at the end of it. Yeah. So he can like play his rock and roll while he's drilling you. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's absolutely, if you haven't seen this movie, it's so much fun, and I really recommend it.
The humor, if you've seen Prom Night 2,
yeah,
which is genius, like a genius Canadian, like it's really funny and surreal. This movie has the same kind of gags that are really quite stunning and funny.
And it knows it's not to be taken seriously, but there is also still a lot of effort put into the style of the film and the look and feel and everything that goes into good filmmaking. Yeah. So,
I loved it so much. I looked up the killer afterwards, and his family owned Little Caesars and the Detroit Red Wings.
Nice.
That's his family. So I was like, he's fine. We don't have to worry about the killer.
I was worried about him, but he's doing fine.
Okay. Last couple, Possessed 2. One thing I sometimes run across, people get bored. They say they're bored of watching movies or they've run their course. And I'm always like, then go watch Hong Kong movies because you'll never be bored again. And Category 3 films, these films that are kind of on the edge of what will never get made there now, obviously. And there are some wild horror film crossover action films. There's a film called Possessed 1, which I hadn't seen before, and it's just okay. Possessed 2 is truly one of the crazier films. At the end, there is a Hare Krishna character who has a massive techno temple that they've created to do exorcisms. And when you get to that part of the movie, your hair blows back from your head. And everything about this film is wild, but it's basically a guy moves into a new apartment with his family. They get possessed by these people who had been killed there years before. And it leads to the wife at one point getting into the back of a butcher vehicle, like a truck with all the hanging meat, seducing someone. There is a love scene surrounded by meat, and as she's climaxing, she turns into a werewolf.
Oh, wow.
And you're watching this movie going, I thought I'd seen everything, but this movie has reinvented what everything means. And it's still funny and not that serious. It's probably on the wildest side of the Hong Kong spectrum, but definitely worth checking out. And maybe not the easiest one.
You just completely sold me.
I mean,
that.
It's like made for you.
Yeah.
I said climax and werewolf. You're boom.
That's all I needed.
Yeah, it's Heidi. It's like, okay, this one, I've always wanted to see this movie, so I haven't seen this one yet.
Yeah, so this film is actually very, it's hard to find. It's okay. Not it's not well known. And I just wanted to because we were just purely talking about covers. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about this cover because it is so cool. And I remember the first time when I was looking for this film, all I could find was were these images. And I love that sort of artwork with the body parts and the dead people under the flooring and the looming shadow. Fiona Louise, I actually don't know too much about her.
I don't know.
It's one of those films that is, it won the winner of the Venice Film Festival, but it's not well known in horror circles and it's just not something that's on a lot of people's radar.
Is it British? It's about a British killer, right?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I've heard of the story, the true crime around it, and I'd heard the title,
but it's based on a true story, but heavily sensationalized. Mm-hmm. So it's basically an exploitation film about a series of murders. Right.
This one I'm putting on my list to watch.
Yeah, for sure.
This. My last one. This is my favorite discovery I've made in the last few years, and I guess the whole world was kind of making it soon after because it was put out finally on something called Rare British B-Sides from the BBC. But this, it's not like anything I've quite ever seen. It has a Lynchian design, but I think it's only like 70 minutes. Called The Appointment. It has Wicker Man's Edward Woodward, and it is a film that basically feels like you're just watching this slow motion dream of dread as it unfolds. But it's really everyone so far have passed this. I was watching a crappy version until they put it out. It's basically a guy's weird relationship to his daughter. There's a lot of like vibes that are like they're never saying they have an incestual relationship, but the feelings there. It's almost maybe like as if Eraserhead's an anxiety dream of having a child, this is an anxiety dream of a father and a daughter and some of the things being thought about that aren't okay. And it creates this very strange feeling at the first half of the film. And then the second half is he has to go on an appointment. He has an appointment to drive somewhere. And he keeps having kind of like Don't Look Now. He keeps having these little flashes, like looks at his watch and gets a weird feeling. And he looks at something else and gets a weird feeling. But it's all culminating to one of the craziest stunt action, like if you don't care, if you're sitting here going, I can't wait till this guy stops talking, go watch The Appointment just for a stunt that will take your breath away in the middle, towards the end of this film with a car thing. It's just, I can't even overhype it. It's like mind blowing what they pull off. And again, it's always tied to this feeling that of the uncanny. And it's one of the few films I would say like wholeheartedly is getting to the similar feeling of what Lynch can do in at his best moments, like in a moment like Mulholland Drive or something like that, where you're fusing dreams. And it's really something unique. And again, I'd never heard of it until the last couple of years. Just one of those things you kind of stumble upon. But yeah, BBC Rare Sides, The Appointment, Edward Woodward is also just the greatest. So, and do we have one more? Oh,
that's it.
That you've been watching Colors of the Dark podcast. We did it.
Thank you so much for letting me do this. This was
Heidi
so much
literally
fun.
Saved my life. I wasn't in people who were out with me last night saw me in an anxiety ball. I was like, oh my God, now I have to do a podcast. I will say, because otherwise my team back there will get mad at me, I also have a film screening here on Friday at 7:15 called The Dead Thing, playing again on Sunday.
At noon.
And it hasn't shown anywhere in the world, so we're very excited to kind of, in fact, almost no one, including a lot of the cast, have actually seen this movie. So very excited. So thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Let's give a cheers for Becca, who's not here. We'll give her a clap.
Becca, feel better. We miss you.
If you're listening. And thank you for saving my ass.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about horror movies.
Oh, of course.
So that's my favorite thing in the world.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you, guys.
The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.